Good evening, everyone. I'm so pleased to start the weekend tonight with Gerald Elias, an author with whom we first became acquainted. I think he's rounded me back in 2000. Well, when was it, 2009, Jerry?
2009, yep.
When he wrote a wonderful book, and not only that, came to the bookstore with it and performed a violin concert. So at that time, well before COVID, we actually thought it'd be interesting to do some chamber music concerts in the store. But Jerry, I have to tell you that we went in a different direction because author James Salas has a wonderful, Patrick can describe it better than I, but a band of banjos and other, you know, other kinds of instruments like that. And they played on the fourth Friday night at the store for several years until COVID shut it down. But we never really got a chamber music concert going.
Well, we'll have to start thinking about that, huh?
Yeah, no, well, it was absolutely wonderful. Dance Macabre, the second book in this wonderful series with violinist Daniel Jacobus. Jerry came back to the store, but we haven't talked to him for a while. So which book is this for Daniel by now?
This is number 7, actually. Yeah, the first 4 were based upon compositions that had to do with the subject of death, so they naturally lended themselves to murder mysteries. The second group of 4 are inspired by Vivaldi's 4 Seasons. So each of the 4 takes place in a different season, Cloudy being a summer chamber music festival. And they all take place in venues where musicians tend to have incentive to want to kill each other. So again, you know, it just lent itself to some mystery writing.
Sarah, this being your 7th book, I can do this math. You must have started with winter with Vivaldi and then gone to spring if this is now summer.
That's correct. Yeah, winter was Playing with Fire, which takes place in a violin shop. Spring Break, of course, was spring and took place in a music conservatory. Summer, chamber music festival on Antelope Island in the Great Salt Lake. And the next one is going to be Murder at the Royal Albert, takes place in London on a concert tour, which typically take place in autumn.
That sounds wonderful. I've actually been to the Royal Albert for a concert. Who was that? Simon Rattle. Sir Simon Rattle was the conductor. And it's really an experience to go there. I can't even remember how many years ago. You know, I can actually. I just remember now. It was before we went to Scotland. So it was in 1997 or 99. Mm-hmm. That long ago. I think it was before he actually became Sir Simon Rattle.
Well, I've played there on a number of occasions with the Boston Symphony. And it really is a unique place to play because it's huge, as you might remember, and it's really kind of cylindrical, and it goes so far up, you know, by the time you look at the top balcony, you can hardly see people, they're so small.
And of course,
it's unique where everyone's on the floor is standing up. And, you know, they have got this tradition of cheering on the musicians, and it's really quite a different experience.
Indeed it is. Don't they have the proms there, what the British call the proms?
Yes, they have the proms there, which are mostly serious concerts. We've played Mahler symphonies on the prom series, and they always get a huge crowd. Sometimes they even get the royalty to attend.
Wonderful. Well, we're talking to Jerry as an author, but I should point out that he is a violinist, a concert master, and also a conductor. So it's really wonderful to read his books if you know, the music part of it is terrific. And in fact, I'm happy to say that in the first part of the book, the lyrics to Vivaldi's 4 Seasons are reproduced, violin concerto in G minor, and you've thoughtfully done it in English and Italian.
Right. Yeah, as I mentioned, you know, all my books have to do with music that were preceded by their own stories. And in the case of the 4 Seasons, Vivaldi wrote sonnets about each of the seasons and wrote this incredible music that reflects the imagery of the sonnets. So you hear bird calls and you hear hunting and you hear you know, the sounds of nature. So they're quite remarkable pieces and very inspiring to write stories from.
It's a gorgeous set of pieces. The last time I heard it, I was telling Jerry before we started, was in Venice, Vivaldi and Venice. I mean, he lived in Venice. Is he the one called the Red Priest? He is, isn't he?
Yes, yes, he was a priest and he had red hair. He never did mass. He spent his life composing and teaching the violin. He was a wonderful violinist. He was employed for well over 30 years at what was sort of a combination convent, yeah, orphanage, and music conservatory. And the girls' orchestra at this convent in Venice was considered one of the greatest orchestras in all of Europe. And many composers wrote music for these girls. And I'm not talking about just a few years, this went on for over a century. So quite a remarkable place that Vivaldi worked in.
Let me add, you know, because my mind is totally full of trivia at all times, that the convent was not a convent in a conventional sense. The Venetians tended to stash their unmarriageable or difficult daughters in the convent, and not all of them took vows or led particularly chaste lives. But so having a music teacher would have been right in sync with what was going on. And, you know, it gave him, as a starving musician, because musicians sometimes can starve, gave him a place to live and a stipend and all the rest. So it was a good deal all the way around. And mm-hmm. we got this fabulous music for it. Jerry, talk to us a bit about Antelope Island. That's the venue for this book, which you have written as a summer festival, in the sense that Tanglewood at Boston, or Ravinia, which is the one I grew up with, Ravinia in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Which, oddly enough, my husband's grandfather, great-grandfather, Julius Rosenwald, donated to Highland Park. It was his summer home, and he donated Ravinia to Highland Park, and it now has become this wonderful venue.
Wow.
So Antelope Island, describe it to us. It's in the Great Salt Lake?
Yes, it's right in the middle of the Great Salt Lake, and yeah, one of our favorite outdoor spots in the world, because it is so different. It's quite a mysterious place, because when you're on it and you look out toward the west, especially, you know, there's this vast expanse of water, and in the distance these mountain ranges that are bare, and when there's no breeze, which is often, it just looks like a different planet almost, especially the light is so different. And it's quite a large island, and it's got mountains on it, and it's got a desert climate. So it's quite a striking place, but it's only about an hour from Salt Lake City. Now, the reason I chose that, I had two reasons for choosing that to come up with a chamber music festival. One is that I wanted to write this murder mystery at a chamber music festival, but if I took a real one, then, you know, people might feel like I was impugning their festival. So I had to make one up, and I had to make one up in a place where there is no festival, or probably can't be a festival. So I chose Antelope Island. And also, I wanted to create something in an Agatha Christie kind of sense, where it ends up that all these people are trapped on the island and they can't get off. And one of them is a homicidal maniac. And so they're all trying to figure out who might have done it and why. And there's such a small population that there aren't all that many choices. So along with the reader, the characters in the book are also trying to figure out who the guy is or who the gal is.
And Then There Were None, which started out with a title I won't claim and then moved to 10 Little Indians and now has been sanitized to And Then There Were None, is a really popular Christie design for mm-hmm. a murder mystery. Sometimes people confuse it with a locked room mystery, but it's not actually. It's different, and it fits into the Gothic design as well. One thing that really struck me when I was reading your description of it, Jerry, I marked it, that's what this piece of paper sticking out of my book is, was that, you know, you've described the view looking west, but if you turn around and look towards Salt Lake City, the Wasatch Mountains are absolutely gorgeous and behind it. So you could swivel around on the island and take in the Wasatch, which are, you know, snowy and full of trees and all the rest of it, and then turn around at this really barren thing. But I remember as a child, my father drove us across country from Chicago to California. He was a president of the General Telephone System. And I can remember as a young child doing all that when interstates were barely going in the whole bit, swimming in the Great Salt Lake. And, you know, you can't actually sink because of the salinity of the lake. But I did want to ask you, since you lived there, is that getting more intense? Is the lake drying up under the climate? And if so, isn't the salinity rising?
I don't know about the salinity. I expect it is increasing. And sadly, the lake is drying up at a frightening rate, partly because of climate change, partly because of 20 years of drought, which might be the effect of climate change, but also because of the growing population of the metropolitan area and the agricultural need for water, which is sucking up so much of the water before it has a chance to even get to the lake. So, you know, at this point, it's almost possible to cross from the island to the Wasatch side, the eastern side, without, you know, having to step in water. It's most of the water is to the north and the west at this point.
Well, you in your book, you have a bridge connecting, or a causeway. But I think it's a bridge, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a causeway. And
When
we first moved to Salt Lake City in 1988, the water level was so high because there had been flooding that the causeway was closed. And that's what kind of gave me the idea. I'm not going to give away too much of the story, gave me the idea for what happens in the book.
Okay, well, Jerry is going to play some of the Vivaldi for us at some point in this conversation, but we're going to carry on for a little bit here. If any of you ever been to Mont Saint-Michel, you'd kind of get the idea, because there is, in fact, used to be that you had to make it across the sands when the tide was out, and woe betide you if you stepped into the quicksand or failed to notice the ocean rolling at you. But they have now created a causeway, which is much safer, and also that way they can take tourists and buses to get there. But the problem with Antelope Island in terms of a music festival is that there's no infrastructure. I mean, there's, you know, there's no sewage, there's no water source, whatever it would be. So you can't support a large group of people. Also, there are what, like free-range bison?
Free-range bison, they usually kind of stay to themselves, and, you know, you drive right past them, sometimes even walk fairly close to them. They usually don't bother anyone, but, you know, some tourists, they think they need to get a close-up shot of them, and that is not a good idea. No. Because they are wild and they are huge. They're the largest land mammals in North America.
Right. We've encountered them in Yellowstone when we had one walk right up to the car. I have a great shot, you know, with my car window rolled up, and here's the bison, you know, swinging down the road towards us and then pausing with his nose practically in the window. And they're huge, but they also produce flies. So, you know, in your book, you've managed to avoid the insect question, but that would be the other thing that would drive you nutty in the summer.
Right. Not only the flies that the bison draw, but the no-see-ums, I think we're all familiar with them. They're so tiny, but they're deadly on Antelope Island between May and I would say the end of September. So we used to visit the island, you know, all the other months and just love it, but never during the summer.
So this would be a fantasy music festival venue, given right. all those conditions, but nonetheless.
As much as I'd love to have a festival there, it ain't going to happen.
No, it's really not. But, you know, it works out very well for the purposes of the plot, in that it's an island, can be isolated. And in theory, you have brought, you know, people there. So tell us about Dan for people who don't know the books. We have two violinists. We have Daniel Jacobus, and then we have Yumi Shinagawa, who is his student. He's been her mentor, and she's right. coming on as a professional musician. She's rising to greater heights.
Yes. Well, Jacobus is quite a curmudgeonly, reclusive, generally, and acerbic, blind violin teacher. And I made him blind because, as we know, people who lose one of their senses sometimes are able to use their other senses in a very enhanced way. And that's the case with Jacobus. He's a great musician. He uses his ears, finely honed. He picks things up that others don't. And also in terms of his sense of smell, sense of touch, all of his other senses are quite enhanced. Also, I made him blind because, you know, he has a very kind of, I would say, cynical view of the world of classical music. And there's a lot to be cynical about. We could talk about that for hours. But by being blind, he metaphorically blocks all of that out. So the only important thing to him is what he hears in the music. And that's one of the reasons why he's such a great teacher. And Yumi, as we know from the very first book, Devil's Trill, when she started out as his student, over the course of the books, gradually blossomed into this world-class violinist. And at the point we find her in Cloudy with a Chance of Murder, she has really established herself and her reputation precedes her. And she is one of a small group of musicians on the island that are participating in this festival. And it's her task in the book to perform Summer from the Four Seasons by Vivaldi. And it's during that performance that things start to happen.
Well, maybe this would be a good point for you to play, because then there's some things to talk about. There are two actual real life incidents that, according to Jerry in his afterword, helped inspire the book. And I think one of them is fascinating to talk about. But why don't you go ahead and play a bit of the Four Seasons, and then we'll merge on into talking about that.
Sure, I've got my violin right here. And may I say that this violin that I'm playing on now was made for me by my son, Jacob.
How
about
wonderful.
A year ago, he decided to become a violin maker and a very proud owner.
Aren't they called luthiers, to be really precise?
Luthiers, yeah. Yeah, as you would imagine, the word luthier started out centuries ago for lute making.
Right.
And as the craft expanded to violins and other string instruments, the name stuck. So any string instrument maker, I think, can be called a luthier. Yeah. So I'm going to play a little bit from Summer, and the storyline kind of generally goes along with Vivaldi's concerto. Mm-hmm. He starts out with describing the heat, the oppressive heat, the blazing sun. He says the flocks are sweltering and the pines are scorched. So he starts out this concerto, unlike just about any other concerto I've ever heard, with the violins feeling very hot and oppressed.
Well, this is the reason to go to the music festival, you see, because, and actually I was going to say something like that, which is that last Sunday, we went down to the Phoenix Symphony to hear a program that was Vocalise, and then it was Beethoven's first symphony, and then it was Rachmaninoff's, I think, third piano concerto, which was an interesting program, because the Beethoven being his first is kind of light, and the Rachmaninoff is, you know. And they had a North Korean pianist who turned out to be a very tall, very strong woman, and she played the Rachmaninoff, as I never heard Rachmaninoff play it. I guess he was fabulous. And Horowitz did a brilliant job, but I like his Emperor Concerto better. And I don't see him as dramatic as Rachmaninoff. He was more of a string kind of guy, more Mozart kind of guy for me. But anyway, this woman played Rachmaninoff like I've never heard it, and the orchestra got all caught up in it. And I'm telling you, it was so electric as they hit the last notes, the entire audience rose to its feet, you know, and excuse me. And that's a reason to go to live music. You know, you can listen to recordings and you can watch things and all the rest of it, but you can't really get that emotion if you're not there in the concert hall, or in my case, in the opera house a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And it's just magic when it happens, and it doesn't happen every time. But if you're lucky and you happen to hit one of those moments when it all comes together and, you know, the audience vibrates in the whole bit, mm-hmm. you just can't you can't replicate that.
You can't. And, you know, I've actually written about that both in nonfiction and fiction formats, because my feeling is that when you're at a live performance, it's not just that you're hearing music with your ears, you're actually feeling the vibrations in your body. And there's something electrochemically that is happening to you, not just in your brain, not just in your ears. And I think that's when you get this synergy between audiences and the audiences and the musicians, where the musicians can actually feel the energy coming from the audience. And it just goes back and forth. And when you have a great performance, you know, it's more than something that you can just listen to at home. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, so hopefully in the near future, when COVID is behind us a bit more, we'll return to the concert hall and really be able to feel that again.
I hope so. I mean, there's a visual component too. I need to correct myself. The woman's name, I believe, is Yang, and she's South Korean. I misspoke when I said North Korean. And mm-hmm. here was the thing. We read in the program notes that she was the silver medalist at the, the Russian violin competition?
The Tchaikovsky competition?
I can't remember. I'm sorry, not violin, piano. Who's the, you know, the famous Russian piano concert? It'll come to me. Anyway, she was the silver medalist. And as we all left, my husband turned to me and he said, who was the gold medalist? I mean, this woman was so remarkable. It was the Van Cliburn, that's it. It'll come to me, the Van Cliburn thing. If she was the silver medalist, we couldn't even imagine who the gold medalist was. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she's obviously, it was some years ago, and as we've been talking, musicians progress. And so perhaps she would be the gold medalist today if she were playing it, but, you know.
Well, you know, those competitions, they are such subjective things.
Yeah.
You know, how do you determine who's better than another when the level is so high? I mean, it's just personal taste, right?
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with it. So in the, we can't talk too much about the mystery. Let us say that Yumi arrives and there's a lot of preparation for the concert, which is going to be under a big tent. Daniel, reluctant to go, eventually shows up through reasons that Daniel, I might add, in an effort to out a murderer earlier, has subjected himself to possible death by mushroom. So he's recovering from that. But anyway, he makes it to the island and there's a murder. Mm-hmm. And then, as often happens, because you can't hardly solve the first murder if you don't have more clues, there's a second murder. and so it goes. But I love the fact that we have this tent and bad things happen, a huge storm. So Jerry, tell us why you were inspired, how you were inspired to write that.
Well, that was one of the two true stories that kind of informed this mystery. When I was in the Utah Symphony, we had one of our summer concerts up at the Snowbird Ski Lodge. And at that time, this is 1991, I believe, they had this big tent that we performed in that sat over 1,000 people. And, you know, summers there, they're very warm during the day. And as the sun goes down, this temperature often drops precipitously because we're up in the mountains at, you know, 7,000-8,000 feet.
That's the dog. I'm sorry, I've locked the puppies out. It's not a violin. She's really doing it.
Well, I just wish my violin had as good sound as your puppies.
Now, hold on a minute, because she's scratching the door down. I'm going to actually let her in.
Okay, let her in.
All right, come on.
Actually, Jerry, a very helpful person on YouTube is giving me some suggestions about how to change the Zoom setting, which I was not aware of. So apparently there's a setting that you can do on Zoom called original sound. Mm-hmm. And I've changed it on my end, but I'm not sure if you have to do it on your end as well. So I don't know. Do you have the violin handy right there? You
want to just violin handy?
Want to just play a few notes and see if it's changed?
I'm happy to do something with the fiddle, but I ain't going to touch the computer.
Okay,
that's a danger zone for me.
All right, so let's
tell me if this is any better.
All right.
You all right? Hmm? You okay?
No.
I think it would have to be on yours too. Well, I have to say that this was my idea to do the violin thing, and obviously I didn't think it through. So my apologies. And
can do is send you a recording of the Four Seasons that we just performed in Salt Lake in December, live performance, and I conducted it. So.
Oh yeah, well, we could actually do that and probably put it on Zoom and see what happens. Or even better, you could come and see us at some point and actually play it.
Well, yeah, again. Very happy to do.
Apparently you need to do it too. So, oh well, this little setting adjustment, but.
Oh, well,
you know, Patrick, it's wonderful. We have not apparently fully learned all of the features of Zoom.
No, but thanks for the person who's pointed that out. We'll know next time.
Yes. We will. Okay. All right, so back to the tent.
So we were at the tent. We were performing with the Kingston Trio that were celebrating like their 30th anniversary together. So we had a big crowd having a lot of fun. And as we're playing, the temperature started to drop, which was not unusual, but it really dropped and it got really dark and the wind started blowing and the rain started. So you could hardly hear anything. It was so noisy because the tent, of course, you know, was not soundproof at all. It was banging on the tent. And then wouldn't you know, a hailstorm started, just like Vivaldi talked about in summer. And the hail came down so fast and so hard that you couldn't hear anything. And the orchestra manager came out on stage and kind of had to shout to the audience that we were going to take a break in the concert. We would leave the stage for a few minutes. And then as soon as the storm stopped, we would come back on and return to the performance. So we all left the stage and we were in the, you know, the resort, the green room there, when all of a sudden the tent collapsed.
Wow.
You know, it really collapsed. It was quite sudden and hundreds of people were trapped under the tent, and turned out several people had taken to the hospital. There were a bunch of injuries. Fortunately, no one got killed, but we had been sitting on this raised elevated stage and the tent was next to where I had been sitting. And when the tent collapsed, it pushed the piano through the stage.
Wow.
So, I mean, if I had been sitting there at that time, it would have been goners for me. So anyway, those were the days before cell phones. So my family, which was back in Salt Lake City, heard on the news that this tent had collapsed, but had no idea what happened to the orchestra. So, you know, everyone was standing at the payphone waiting to put their quarters in to call home. And it really was hours before things got sorted out. And it was in the news. It was a once in a lifetime event. So that was one of the stories that kind of informed Cloudy when I came to write it.
Nobody actually died though, despite the
no one died, and actually the injuries turned out not to be serious, which was quite a miracle. But if not for the quick thinking of our orchestra manager, it probably would have been much, much worse.
Absolutely true. And the other incident that helped inspire your novel is an interesting one, because there have been, and we actually had a brief encounter with that ourselves, this idea of microaggressions or comments that, you know, are perceived, if not intended and not generally disseminated, can still be seen as a microaggression and lead to consequences. So you have a conversation in real life between two people that actually cost somebody their position.
Yeah. And I'm not going to name names in our discussion.
No.
But yeah, some things were said between two colleagues, musical colleagues, that were perceived as racist by someone who overheard. And that was reported to the administration of a certain musical organization. And the person who made the comment was fired. And of course, you know, when that happens, word spreads around the world, you know, faster than COVID. And that can really ruin someone's career. So even the person who was the recipient of that supposedly racist comment said, no, we're friends. You know, it was just a joke. You know, you're totally misinterpreting this. But the organization felt that, you know, the public needed to feel that this organization was taking a proactive response, and fired this musician. Fortunately, it didn't hurt his career. He continued to conduct, and I think to this day has made a good career as a conductor. So that was the other true story that became very critical in my mystery.
Well, and when you have a relatively small universe, which is the classical music universe, you know, something like that can become common parlance in that community. Because as you say, it spreads like lightning, but it's also relatively small. So, you know, it can have a larger than life impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and as you mentioned, it is a small universe. And, you know, in this profession, musicians, they travel from one state to another, from one country to another. It really is this incredible blend, which is a great thing. Because as a musician, I can go just about anywhere in the world, and within 15 minutes of working with someone else, we know what friends we have in common. But in the same way, rumors can get started and spread, and, you know, there might be some truth to them. Often there's very little truth to them, but they can be very damaging to careers.
Yeah. They absolutely can. Another feature of the book, which some of you might find interesting, is the role of a festival manager, because, you know, there's a lot of logistics when you're going to convene any large number of people. Some of whom, the musicians, are going to be there for days or weeks, you know, in prep, and others, you know, just moving audiences back and forth and so forth. It's a tremendous job. I mean, I don't know if any of you hang around to the end of a film and you see the, you know, the gigantic rolling endless list of credits, and, you know, you come down, I mean, there's the caterer and there's the, you know, I mean, it takes a community to support making a movie, and it takes a community to put on a festival. Yeah. And somebody has to be in charge of all of that. And so that's part of the story here is who is in charge of the festival and how is that person perceived? What does that person do? And, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I intentionally kept the staff of this music festival very small.
Very small.
Because I didn't want to have to write War and Peace.
You didn't want rolling credits like the movies.
Right. But you're absolutely right. You know, you take a festival like Tanglewood with the Boston Symphony.
Yeah.
And, you know, the orchestra has 100 members, which to start out with is a big orchestra. But the number of staff and administrators and support staff, you know, far exceeds the number of musicians. But really, that's what it takes, you know, the marketing, development, you know, you name
it. The ticket office and so forth. I mean, I'm a patron of the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival. And I mean, for 50 years, probably I've done that. And it's really been interesting to watch the festival evolve from more of a local kind of amateur organization to a more sophisticated one. Mm-hmm. But even now, you know, they're sending out ticket requests and programming and so forth for something that will happen in July. You know, so they've been probably booking in musicians and everything 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. In order to, you know, we have a very good local chamber music society, the Phoenix Chamber Music Society, which I'm sorry to say I quit going to because I can't stand their venue downtown in the Methodist Church. There's nothing about it that I like, so I don't go anymore. But I love the group, and did some remarkable things with musicians and have kept it going during COVID in various ways. But I'm pretty sure that they were planning booking like 3 years out. Mm-hmm. You know, to make it work and then have all the support staff and everything that goes with it. What's your experience with festivals? I mean, you conducted at festivals, right, as well as played?
Well, for the most part, I have either performed as a soloist. There's Sun River Festival up in Oregon that I performed at a couple of times. And of course, with the Boston Symphony at Tanglewood, many, many years of performing there in the orchestra. You know, I will say that, you know, the festivals are sort of this microcosm of what music organizations do. And because they're a microcosm, they tend to be kind of high stress activities, you know, whether it's in the staff and management or the musicians, you know, things have to be put together very quickly. And, you know, there's a great deal of intensity. And as a result of that, there is often, you know, some degree of friction. And it's that kind of friction which I've tried to build upon in this book, Cloudy, so that, you know, in addition to making what I hope is a compelling, interesting, page-turning story, it does kind of reflect reality. You know, the relationship between musicians and management, which, you know, often is clashing, but also within the administration itself and among the musicians themselves. You know, all these perceived slights, you know, all these feelings of not being treated fairly. You know, and when you're in a situation like I created on Antelope Island, you know, these things tend to get magnified, you know, and there's a kind of this combustible quality to it, especially.
There absolutely is. You know, what else you did though, that there's the other puppy who's come wandering in, but he's quiet. the other thing that I thought you did really well was when Yumi is there, when she first gets there and she's thinking about what she's going to play and who the other musicians are, and she, you know, she does a kind of analysis and recognizes that there's at least a couple of pieces that people who don't normally play together are going to have to play in this festival. They're going to become like a, you know, a little chamber music group, but mm-hmm. they aren't normally. But the pieces are such that that they have performed them with other people in other venues. So they should be able, she says, in a week, you know, to negotiate how they're going to play it as though they were the, you know, Juilliard String Quartet or the Amadeus Trio or whatever it might happen to be. Mm-hmm. I really like that, you know, the fact that, you know, it's not just playing the music, but, you know, it's playing it with colleagues. I mean, that's one reason I love chamber music. And it used to be you could go to rehearsals at the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival. Mm-hmm. And that was even more interesting than the concerts most of the time, because, you know, you got to sit there and watch the musicians negotiate. Mm-hmm. Because there's not really a conductor in a chamber music group, you know, I mean, a small group before they have to figure it out themselves as an ensemble. And usually they end up picking one person, like it's usually the violinist, but it could be, I guess it could be the cellist or whatever.
Yeah, I remember when I was a student at Yale, I attended the Norfolk Chamber Music Festival there. And the resident quartet was the Guarneri Quartet.
Mm, wonderful.
And I would watch them rehearse every day. And boy, the arguments that they would get into. The first violinist of it, Arnold Steinhardt, wrote a really, really wonderful memoir called Indivisible by Four. I highly recommend it, where he talks about they had this policy of not complimenting each other. Very explicit policy, because they felt, if I compliment you, then you're going to feel obligated to compliment me. And after a while, it's not going to be sincere anymore. So we're just going to be critical of each other and just try to make things better. And wow. I mean, you know, sometimes you can see the steam coming off their heads. But what a learning experience for me, and what a string quartet they were. Just astounding.
And usually there can be a romance. I was there in Santa Fe at the debut of a wonderful pianist called Wu Han. And mm-hmm. meantime, there was a group, I can't remember what they were called then, but they had a really, I'm pretty sure he was the cellist, brilliant cellist. And eventually he wound up, come here, you can show off too. Eventually, they wound up married, the cellist, and this is the other puppy.
Aww.
Isn't he adorable?
The sweetheart.
Yep, they're Cavapoos, and you know they weigh about 12 or 13 pounds each, and they are now 6 months old. So they've grown up some. Yes, I know, you're adorable, and I love you. Yes, I do. So, you know, there's romance, there's tension, there's rivalry, there's jealousy, you know, there is, you know, lots of mysteries have been set in theaters. You know, Niall Marsh, who wrote for the theater and all, she did a couple of wonderful Golden Age mysteries about, you know, murders in theaters and acting companies and all the rest of it. So there's no reason to assume that, you know, musicians and music companies aren't the same.
Yeah. Right? Well, one of the things I like about any good mystery author is the ability of the author to kind of help you enter this world that you don't know anything about. But within a few pages, a few chapters, you really feel like you're part of it. You feel welcome into that world, whether it's Walter Mosley's, one of my favorites, Donna Leon, I love her, you know, Brunetti mysteries, Lawrence, even going back, Lawrence Sanders and Dick Francis, you know, they all knew their world intimately. And you don't need to know anything about it when you start the book. By the time you finish the book, you feel, yeah, I'm comfortable in this world. So even though people might not know anything about classical music, it is one of my goals to really open the doors to that world so that, you know, even if you've never heard the music, even if you know nothing about what goes on backstage, by the time you finish the mystery, you'll think, yeah, this is a really interesting world. I want to learn more about it. And sorry I wasn't able to perform more for you today, but, you know, please do listen to the music. It is so great. And, no.
Yes, it is. I mean, the Vivaldi is truly wonderful. If any of you ever traveled to Venice, you've almost surely, you know, heard it, because it's like all the time, all the time there. And I was thinking when you mentioned Donna Leon's first book, you know, Death at La Fenice, which is the opera house in Venice, which sadly burned down before I ever got to it. And now there's a replacement La Fenice, but I have not felt moved to go to it because I'm pissed that I didn't go to the original in time. But anyway, so I wasn't sure whether Donna was going to be writing. We've become good friends and we're going to debut her next book on Saturday. I think it's March 12th. Yeah, at 10 in the morning because she's in Europe. But I wasn't sure it wasn't going to be musical based series, you know, I mean, because there we were in La Fenice and a conductor is the victim. And, you know, you need to know a lot about classical. She needed to know a lot about it in order to write that particular book. But then it turns out that she moved on to all the other theaters in Venice, you know, I mean, social issues and landscapes and all the rest of it. So it isn't a musical based series, but it's a wonderful book to read if you haven't. And I think it was made into a film. Or maybe it was just part of the Donna Leon, you know, there was a German company that did the Donna Leons, which I always thought was somewhat bizarre because they didn't really look like Italians or talk like Italians, but
they anyway. Did four or five of her books. And yeah, it was strange to see them speaking German in Venice with subtitles. But then again, you know, when we make movies, Hollywood movies that take place in foreign countries and they speak English.
Right.
You know, I guess you have to get used to it.
You do. Well, any of you are interested in, you know, music or theater as backgrounds, I should try to pull together a list of mysteries that you can read that will take you into these different worlds. You know, and in their own way, they're, you know, it could be like murder in a tech company or murder in a law office or whatever. You know, anytime you can take a relatively small world, you can do a very Agatha Christie sort of story with it because, you know, it's basically the English country house murder just relocated to, you know, might be a drug lab, might be a hospital. It could be a whole lot of things. Agatha was, she was right there trying to, you know, there are not that many plots that she didn't actually write at some point in her storied career. Anyway, Patrick, come and see if we have any questions aside from people who may be unhappy that we couldn't do the chamber music. And I'm very apologetic about that.
No, there were some really helpful tutorials.
Oh yeah? So we've learned?
It's something that Jerry has to do on his end as well. And I think, Barbara, you needed to be muted. I think we all needed to be muted except for Jerry.
Ah.
Well,
at some point, we'll practice first and then try this again.
Yeah. Let's see. Jerry, one of your friends, Sergio, flutist friend of Jerry's. Mm-hmm. He says that he spent 2 years teaching online, and it's a special setting to maximize the quality of a musical instrument, blah, blah, blah. Let's see here. Okay, the questions come in on YouTube. Jerry, any thoughts about who would play Daniel is it Jacobus or
Jacobus?
Jacobus. Yeah,
in a movie version of your stories.
Hmm. Yeah, I've thought a lot about that. Do you know the actor Tony Shalhoub by any chance?
Monk.
Yeah, Monk. Yeah, of course. And also first Big Night, if you remember that movie. I think he's a wonderful, versatile actor, and my visual image of Jacobus and Shalhoub kind of overlap quite a bit. So, and I think he's a wonderful actor, both for dramatic acting and comic acting. And Jacobus has this acerbic sense of humor that I think he'd be very good with.
So, wow, you know, you're almost the first author we've asked that question who actually had an answer. That's impressive.
And an interesting.
So, you know, I mean, the series has been going on now since 2009.
Yeah.
So I've had quite a few years to kind of fantasize about whether it be made into a film.
Priscilla would like to know, she says, were you worried that people wouldn't like Yumi's promiscuity? Are you planning to have Yumi take a bigger role in the stories? And will Nate take a bigger role as well?
Well, some might view her sexuality as promiscuous. I don't really necessarily agree with that. She is a strong-willed and liberated woman. And, you know, she has her flings from time to time.
There is a funny double standard there, isn't there?
Well, I think not necessarily double standard, but not necessarily a standard that I, you know, feel need to label her with.
Right.
So I don't have trouble with her that way. Some might. I remember when my first book came out, Devil's Trill, some of my former students in Salt Lake City who are members of the LDS Church read the book and were somewhat horrified with Jacobus's language, which can sometimes become quite profane. So from their point of view, they were kind of quite alarmed by it. But then again, Jacobus spent a lot of time living in New York City, where such language is just kind of commonplace. So I guess it all depends on one's perspective. Regarding, you know, how much of a role she will play in the future, or Nathaniel will play, who is Jacobus's other dear friend, you know, that changes from book to book, depending really upon the story and the need for, you know, developing one of those characters through the plot. For example, in Death and Transfiguration, Nathaniel did a lot of sleuthing on Jacobus's behalf in Prague. So anyway, they come and go. I mean, they're always a fixture, the three of them in all the books. And then there are also some other secondary characters that do come and go.
I'm so glad you mentioned Prague. I was thinking to myself when you were talking about the tent, some years ago, quite a few years ago, I went with a Northwestern University group, because I'm an alumni in graduate school, on a trip to Europe. And we went to Prague, where I had never been at that point in time. And everybody else is kind of wiped out and whatever it is. But I happened to cruise past the desk and somebody mentions there's going to be a chamber music concert starting in an hour or two. And it's going to be located in the home above Prague where Mozart wrote Don Giovanni. Mm-hmm. And we're famously, you know, on a rock slab or table or whatever it was, mm-hmm. overlooking the city where Don Giovanni premiered. He dashed off, you know, the overture at the last second, the whole bit, and I can't pass that up. So it was my first venture with Uber, you know, got myself a ride and departed, leaving the people running the tour going, wait, you know, you're going off into the night in Prague, we may never see you again. Didn't care. So I arrived and the venue for the chamber music, it's outside. So they're on a stage, like you mentioned, it's relatively small and the audience is in the garden and we're all in chairs in the whole bit. And they start the concert and it starts to pour and you know what? Nobody moved. I mean, the audience sat there with the rain pouring down and the musicians, they had umbrellas. And they put up their umbrellas and eventually it got so heavy that they took a short break because the you know, the violins were getting wet and they were worried about them. So they had to drive off, but the audience continued to sit there in the rain. And eventually in a brief intermission, I went off and paid homage to Mozart by standing there looking down at the, you know, at the theater where he did. And then the next night we went to see Don Giovanni. So it was absolutely magical. But I've always remembered how, you know, the chamber music, the whole thing was so compelling that despite the fact that it was absolutely pissing down with rain, mm-hmm. everybody stayed in their place, including me.
Well, a magical moment.
It was, yeah. But real dedication. So maybe the message is you didn't need the tent.
Yeah. Maybe.
That was the point of that story, is maybe you could have done without the tent, but the hail probably would have killed people. So maybe not a good idea. Maybe. Anything else, Patrick?
Yeah. Let's see. Anne asks, how do you develop your characters? Do you base them on people you know, or are they complete inventions?
A lot of the characters are I would say amalgams of people I know. You know, it's usually not one to one, especially if it's a villain, because I don't want people to think, oh, that he thinks that's me, you know. I would say the most complex character, who really is mostly a figment of my imagination, is Jacobus. I was inspired in creating him by two people that I've known in my life. One is Alexander Schneider, Sasha Schneider, who was the second violinist of the Old Budapest Quartet, and with whom I worked when I was a student, and was just so passionate about music and explained music so beautifully and so intensely. And I learned so much from him. And again, my visual image of Jacobus is a lot like Sasha Schneider. And the other person is someone who's been a friend of mine since junior high school, a young lady at the time, when I was in junior high, who played the violin and who gradually went blind herself, but never gave up playing the violin and never gave up having an absolutely normal life. She became a guidance counselor in a high school, has a family, has kids, continues to play the violin and the viola in string quartets and in orchestras, having memorized everything that she plays. And she's an inspiring friend and a remarkable person. And a lot of Jacobus comes from her. So yes, you know, some of the characters are, you know, based upon people I know, but usually, you know, not exactly one-to-one, and not necessarily even in the same profession as who they end up with in the stories, so.
Have there been many mysteries, Barbara, that that deal with the classical music milieu?
Well, I'm so glad you asked, because our February 1st mystery book of the month is called The Violin Conspiracy. And in fact, it is about a Black performer from, I think, Brooklyn. I'll have to check it, but anyway, Brooklyn, I think. And he has a Stradivarius, and he is about to do something really important. And he's in a hotel room in New York, and when he leaves to go to wherever it is he went, can't remember, his violin is stolen. It disappears. And this is a real tragedy. And what's interesting in many ways is he writes about what it's like to try to crack the world of classical music as a Black performer. But the story of how he got the Strad, considering his family background and so forth, is really remarkable, and I must say entirely plausible, or, you know, I wouldn't have been interested in it. It's getting a very large play. And then Tess Gerritsen, Patrick, wrote a book, remember that, a few years back, not even that long ago, about a violin and so forth. She's interested, so she's going to do the program with me when we talk to Mr. Slocum. There's Donald Leon's book that I mentioned to you. There was there was a whole series of books set in.
There's the Schweitzer, is that his name, that does the kind of lighthearted.
Church choir, yeah, Mark, I think is it Mark something? Somebody Schweitzer.
Schweiker, yep.
Yeah, it's a.
The tenor wore tap shoes and.
Yeah, and so there have been. Jerry, maybe you're more familiar with this than I am. What could you recommend?
Well, there's a book that was written a while ago named Canone in Verso. I can't remember the author offhand, but it's about this young working class boy who is given a Guarneri he's a talented violinist, in order to study in this Austrian conservatory. And it's quite sort of very intense, complex story. He befriends, and it takes place in Austria, Germany, Hungary, right before World War II. So there's a lot of political push and pull in it. He befriends this kind of aristocratic young man, but then when political pressures on this wealthier kid's family. They cause a rift in their friendship, and it becomes a very philosophical book as well as being a story about music. So
I'm laughing because the big dog just came in. She
how many dogs do you have?
We have three. We have an older dog. Robert Barnard, I'm pretty sure it was Robert Barnard, wrote three or four mysteries with Mozart.
Right.
Don't I remember that? Like the Mozart conspiracy or some such thing? And then there was somebody else, and I can't remember the name, that did write several mysteries that involved ancient instruments, not modern instruments, but an ensemble that played, the older things. And those were wonderful. I read every one of them. And of course, you think I could remember them now, but I can't. There have been, but I don't think there's a long running current series other than Jerry's that is really strictly in the world of classical music. Can you think of one, Jerry?
Not in terms of a series, no. Standalone.
It tends to be more like, Tess with a passion for a particular story. There have been one or two historicals too, and almost always about violins, because classical violins, Strada and Guarnieri, are so unbelievably valuable that most of the books that involve them revolve around money or the value of the instruments. And
what was that book you published, Fiddle Game?
Yeah, there was that. And then actually Richard thinking Thompson. About it, there's a woman who I can't think of the three books, but I think she's written three involving a professional pianist. But we haven't ever talked to her, so that's why my mind is kind of a blank.
Beverly Graves Myers, is it?
Yeah, that was just one. He was a castrati. That was the world of opera. There had been. And the Library of Congress Crime Classics, which Poison Pen Press actually began, so they're under the Library of Congress Poison Pen Press imprint, is publishing the one mystery ever written by Helen Trouble, the great Wagnerian soprano. It's called Murder at the Met. And anyone who's an opera fan will know from the beginning who the villain is, but it'll be fun for you to confirm it. And, it's not a great mystery, but it really takes you into the whole world of the Metropolitan Opera. And I think she must have been in the 50s that it published. So anyway, we're going to have that either next month or in March, and I'm really looking forward to it. I reread it before they agreed to make it one of the Library of Congress Crime Classics, and I thought it had held up really well.
I don't know if I mentioned to you, but I no longer live in Utah. I last spring moved to Seattle to be a hands-on grandparent.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so new life here in Seattle, but I have met some musicians and authors here who write books that take place in the world of classical music. One is Erica Miner, is an author and former violinist at the Met. And another is Charles Martin, who was a string bass player in the Hong Kong Philharmonic, who's written, one book that's out of print now, but was a terrific book that takes place in the world of classical music in Hong Kong called Neon Panic, which if you can get your hands on a copy of it, I highly recommend.
Well, lucky you. If you're in Seattle, they do the ring cycle there every once in a while. You can go and wallow in Wagner if you want to. Wonderful. Are there any other questions, Patrick?
No, but someone points out very helpfully that Sherlock Holmes played the violin. Morse sang in a choir, mm-hmm. And then this person also points out the Red Violin, of course, the movie about that, the famous Strad, which was great. I don't think it was based on a book, but could have been.
Right. Yeah, right. Well, that's true, but I don't ever think of Sherlock Holmes as a music, oriented series, but you're absolutely right. He did play the violin to to relax. So anyway, this has been fun. My apologies that we didn't bring off the concert, but we've learned from that. So we'll entice Jerry back to talk about his next book, and we will do better.
Murder at the Royal Albert comes out in December. So maybe by then we will have fixed our technological challenges.
Well, or you could actually come see us live by then. Who knows
how the world will be.
Anyway, it was a nice way to start a Friday night. So Jerry, thank you very much for your time. Thank you all for watching and for your patience and for not, you know, screaming over about our lack of a concert. But anyway, Cloudy with the Chance of Murder. You're welcome to order a copy from us at any time. At The Poison Pen, it's a book easily obtained. So bye. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.